So welcome, everyone. This is Mark Gosney, and I'm here with a good friend and colleague and wonderful teacher, Andrew Cohen. And this is the third, actually, of our dialogues, which has taken place over the last year. And each one is to try and clarify a particular issue arising in the Dharmic field, which is the field of the pursuit of truth, you know, the deepest nature of what is that allows us to live in the most fully integrated, alive, unique, authentic way that we can, participating in giving all that we have, that's the unfolding and evolving of reality to the highest good, the highest true, and the highest beautiful. And this week, we're here to talk about love, and that's our topic, and to kind of continue, in some sense, an earlier conversation we had about love, and to try and find our way into some distinctions around loving. So first, Andrew, I love you. Welcome. It's great to be with you.
Thank you.
We can spend the rest of the time figuring out what that means.
Well,
that's fantastic.
I assume it means something really good.
It's for sure really good, right? That's for sure. There's no question about that whatsoever. So let's kind of really just kind of feel our way into that, what that really good thing is. And maybe I'll begin with a question, you know, which is really what, and share with people a little bit of the behind the scenes that initiated this particular Dharma conversation. And Andrew, you'll recount differently if I'm inaccurate in any way. Andrew and I had done a dialogue in the Future of Love series. A little while after that dialogue, and it was a dialogue on love, a little while after that dialogue, Andrew, you posted a fantastic blog post on loving. And I think even some of the talkbacks in the blog post said, hey, so excited to hear, you know, Andrew, you're blogging about love. This is great. Heard you and Gosney talking about love. You know, Andrew, this blew me away. It was really, a blog post that had a lot of impact on a lot of people.
I didn't know that. That's good. That's good to hear.
Yeah. It was the talkbacks actually kind of referred back that they had kind of heard, you know, our dialogue, and they were excited about the blog post. And I think if I remember what happened, this was like last June, could be, that I read the blog post. And then I shot you an email, or we talked on the phone, and as we tend to do, we have a kind of large shared resonance and field of meaning, but as you said the other day on the phone, a kind of different way of emphasizing things, which of course is natural and fructifying, meaning it's actually helpful to actually see the distinction.
What's that word? That's a new word.
Fructifying. That's a good one, right?
Fructifying. Fructifying means?
Meaning, you know, it's kind of helpful. It makes it more richer. Makes it as in fructose, as in kind of the richness of kind of dipping. It's deeply sweet. So fructifying as in makes it deeper, more richer, more textured. I actually haven't used the word in a while. It just popped through my mind. So thank you for the for the double click into fructifying. So, Andrew said the other day on the phone that, you know, we kind of tend to have different emphasis. So it's not so much as a formal disagreement. It's more of a kind of different way of telling the story, but emphasis matters. It's actually significant. And so in this blog, yeah, absolutely matters. It's a big deal. So in this blog post, Andrew, you had spoken about the distinction between absolute and relative love. And the blog post actually kind of hinged on that distinction. And you wrote something like, you know, before we awaken to kind of the absolute love, we're in the merely personal and relative love. And, you know, we had kind of had a very brief exchange then was about this distinction, which I tend against, right? In other words, for lots of reasons, that distinction between absolute love and relative love, while it stands, for lots and lots of reasons, I would tend to kind of actually blur that distinction and see it in a different way. So I thought maybe the best place to start was, if that makes sense with you, is let's start with perhaps just present that distinction or present your understanding of that distinction, and maybe we go back and forth and kind of begin from that conversation. Does that feel okay?
That feels great.
Okay.
This is going to be an interesting conversation because as you've been recounting the historical precursors to this conversation, and then you brought up the distinction between relative love or absolute love. As you were saying that, I was realizing that those distinctions between the distinction between what we could call relative or absolute, which we'll talk about, also takes different, it takes on different meaning, and will mean different things depending upon the level of development of the individual, the stage of the development of the individual, etc. So, you know, I definitely want to try and avoid making overly simplistic definitions here, but. And I suppose when we speak about it, we will look into all the inherent subtlety of making these kind of distinctions, especially when we look at these distinctions within the context of a developmental model,
right,
of evolution in general. But I think especially in the post I wrote about love, I was. Making a fundamental distinction between spirit, between love that is the nature of spirit, and anything that we could see as being less than the full uninhibited, wholehearted, unconditional embrace of what that word could really actually mean. So I think, and I, if you remember, because I haven't really thought about this probably since I wrote that, but the reason that I wrote that is because that word is used by a lot of people to mean a lot of different things, you know. And I remember I began saying, well, and often I, it's a difficult word to use. It's a very charged word. Because when people use it, everybody's pretty sure that they know exactly what they're talking about. So when people use the word love, I say, well, before I answer the question in relationship to love, I have to know, what are you speaking about? Because I say, well, I love spaghetti. I love my dog, and I really do. I really do love Italian pasta very much. I love it deeply. I love my. I actually have two dogs now, not one.
Oh wow!
I have a Yorkshire Terrier and a German Shepherd. You met my little Yorkshire Terrier, and
I did.
I love my dogs. I love my wife. I love my students. I love my friends. I love all kinds of things. and then there is the whole nature of the whole. Then there's the whole issue of what happens when we awaken to the nature of spirit itself, and when that awakening is profound, there's a recognition that there's a direct, you know, precognitive recognition that the nature of spirit itself is love.
Mm-hmm.
That the deepest nature of who we are is love. But in my experience, what I discovered is it's not the kind of love that is soothing. It's not the kind of it's not a mother's love, or it's not love that is affectionate, or even consoling or supporting. It's a love that is absolutely overwhelming, and we almost could say, or not almost, that unless we're willing to come to our knees in the face of its overwhelming nature and truth, it's quite terrifying, because it is so, so all-encompassing and so inconceivably profound that if there's any part of ourselves that is unwilling to submit, to let go, to receive it and be overwhelmed by it without hesitation, it will be frightening. But if we're willing to let go and to submit without conditions, you know, that kind of non-relative, absolute, spiritual love, the love of God or the love that is God, you know, will become the source of the self that we are, and will be the energetic driver of our actions
mm-hmm.
and of our embrace of the world, and what we're going to be expressing then is a kind of love and a care and a concern for what's happening in this world that's very, very different than the love of anything personal, than the love of for one's animals or for one's wife or even one's friend. It's really a care for the process itself, and it's a care for where that process is going. And there is a there's an unconditional that kind of care is unconditional. It's that concern and that care is there regardless of what the conditions are or what actually is going to happen. One finds oneself kind of after that in kind of a very choiceless, you know, embrace of the life process, where one doesn't have any choice anymore. You know, the fundamentally personal motivations for living this life and for being in this world have been pushed aside now, and something else has taken over that is guiding our the important choices that we make, the important actions that we take, and it is that absolute love that cares in a way that's very difficult to understand. That cares with a kind of passion that could be terrifying.
Right.
Which doesn't really recognize relative distinctions, I must say. Which cares with a kind of passion that's very difficult to describe about this process. But I mean, but even before we would even speak about it in such a way that we're saying it's an expression of care for the process, it's just the nature. It's the nature and quality of that love itself that is overwhelming. And I can say in my own life, my I had two introductions to the nature of this mm-hmm. love. And one was, the first was, and I think I described in that piece, I was 16 years old. I was sitting up one evening having a conversation with my mother, and I suddenly the doors of perception opened, and I suddenly became aware of the fact that the whole universe was one living being that was self-aware and self-conscious, and the nature of that being was a kind of love that literally was physically unbearable to directly experience. It was physically painful. And at the same time, I was overwhelmed with ecstasy. So it was a kind of mm-hmm. ecstasy that was physically, it was emotionally, but also on a physical level, unbearable. I felt like I was going to explode, and I felt if this doesn't stop, it's just too much. And there were mm-hmm. tears streaming down my cheeks, and I was stunned. I was in awe. Before this event happened, you know, I had been brought up as a secular Jew, so I was more basically an atheist. And this experience ended that particular orientation.
Mm-hmm.
I was literally brought to my knees, and I was even though I was sitting in a chair, I was in my soul, I was on my knees, and I was stunned. I mean, I couldn't believe it, and I knew this was the most real. The most real experience that I ever had of anything. I knew that every other moment that I'd been alive up until that one had been more or less relative or illusory in comparison to the overwhelming reality of the nature of the quality of this overwhelming love that was revealing itself to me. And it was, had been unsought. And so that was the first experience. And the second was in meeting my teacher, H.W.L. Punja, after spending three weeks with him, he told me, he said, well, now, after these 3 weeks, and I was going to leave, I left for after a few weeks, he said, something big's going to happen. I said, well, I didn't really believe him. And after I left him, I was sitting in the train, at the train station, and I remember I felt something come over me. I didn't know what it was, but it was something came over me from within the deepest part of myself, and I felt I was being drawn within to the deepest part of myself. So I was being meditated by a force and a power and energy and intelligence that was coming from within. And after that, I was absorbed in this meditative current, this meditative process that I think for about 3 weeks was literally consuming my being. For that 3 week period, I was aware that the sense was that I was being, that everywhere I was, there was an unseen presence that was pursuing me, that was following me, that I experienced as a burning sensation in my solar plexus and in my heart.
Mm.
And it had that same quality as that original experience I had when I was 16, and this happened when I was, the second experience happened when I was 30. And it was the same experience of it being it was unbearable ecstasy, but it was also too much. It was ecstatic, and it was also overwhelming and painful and also frightening. I felt like I was being consumed, or to put it frankly, I felt like I was being consumed or eaten alive by the force of this energy, this intelligence, this ecstasy that was literally felt like consuming me at a soul level. And I remember thinking to myself, if this doesn't stop, there's going to be nothing left of me. You know, I am dying.
Mm.
But the essential nature or quality of this energy and this intelligence and this consciousness was a kind of love that is, for lack of a better term, non-relative or absolute. In other words, it has nothing to do, it doesn't relate to, it's on a different level of comprehension and of experience than any love that's for any individual or any other being, because it is really it is the deepest nature of self.
Mm.
It's the deepest nature of who we all are once we actually awaken to it. So it's not only the nature of the self is love that is not relative, but it's the ultimate nature of everything that is. It's the nature of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And when we realize it, it is completely overwhelming, and it doesn't recognize relative distinctions. It really doesn't.
That's a good start.
That was my introduction to that was when I discovered what spiritual love really is. I mean, I had. Before that, I very much loved my. When I was younger, I had a very close relationship with my mother. I loved her very much. I had close friendships. I knew what it was to love my friends. I had a very passionate and romantic relationship with an Italian partner or girlfriend who'd been my lover, and we really had a very passionate romantic interlude that was quite intoxicating. So I really had experienced forms of love and intimacy that were powerful and profound and real and meaningful. But in light of,
mm-hmm.
my experience or my discovery of love as the nature of spirit, there was no comparison. I mean, we're talking about a completely different order of magnitude that one almost has no relationship, or literally has no relationship to the other, because all the other forms of love all were very much related to my ego or Andrew's separate notion of self or his psychological self and psychological identity and culturally conditioned identity. And this other kind of love I discovered had no relationship to anything except itself.
Right.
It's love that only knew itself, and when we awaken to it, it seemed that, and of course this is just a, this is a conceptual interpretation, it seemed that what was driving this love was to try and consume everything in its path, to absorb everything into itself, into its primordial unity and singularity, and the absolute liberation that was found there. So discovering this different order of life, I discovered this. Well, this is why to make this distinction between relative or absolute is because what I discovered was a completely different order of experience that really didn't relate to any relative distinctions in relationship to how we can talk about what love means. It was a completely different order of experience. So when I began to teach, I discovered that in light of what I had discovered and now what was really driving me and compelling me to do the work that I was doing as a spiritual teacher, there was an energy that was driving me that also would not recognize relative distinctions, that was looking only for unconditional release and unconditional submission and unconditional surrender. In all those who are coming to me for spiritual liberation, and the energy and intelligence that was driving me was seeking only for that in them for their own release. Mm-hmm. And recognize anything other than that as infinitely far from really the starting point, because in a sense that once we come down on both knees and we say and it's a true submission, not my will be done but thy will be done, it's not really the end, it's really the very beginning of a completely new kind of life. It's a completely different relationship to what it means to be a human being, a completely different relationship to what it means to be the human beings who we have been, and so it's coming to the end of the relationship to life that we had before, but it's really the beginning of an infinite adventure, and now we're human beings who recognize that we're actually spirit incarnate, and we're here for a very big purpose, and in this case, It's to bring to the light of spirit and to the love of spirit, you know, into the manifest world, and that is a ferocious there's a ferocious intentionality and a fearlessness in that awakened inspiration. You know, for those individuals who have awakened in this way, there is a ferocity, and I remember, even though I've never been much of a reader, I remember that hearing those famous words of Christ, apparently he was he was walking with his disciples, I think, if my memory of this particular story is correct, and that I think they found a dead body, and if my memory is correct here, I think in Jewish law, the burying the dead is very holy, it's very sacred. Right, and he said, let the dead bury the dead, because we don't have time right now, there's something more important. And so what I noticed was that there was a quality in the ferocity of the intentionality of the nature of the spirit that was driving me, that it was because I was directly experiencing that as driving me that I understood, I see why he would have said such a thing. Why would a rabbi act in disregard of the law? And I realized that because in the face of this kind of urgency and this kind of passion, that's where that kind of sentiment would come from. So.
No, that's so. So it's about the only way you can end that, Andrew. That's beautiful. That's gorgeous. I mean, I appreciate you did it, you know, in a relatively short amount of time. You could talk about this for hours, but it takes 15 minutes just to even begin to to touch it, and that gives a great depth to that distinction, right, that you're making between the relative, right, the absolute, and when you talk about, you know, there's, you know, one literally has no relationship to the other, right, you know, or that, you know, this love that doesn't really recognize relative distinctions, and this kind of overwhelming sense of it, and it's so all of that and all of.
No, but as you've just been saying, it doesn't recognize other and other because it is the only
right,
one
it is.
That is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
is the only one that there is. So, therefore, it cannot. And
right, by definition.
Not, it will, by definition, will not recognize the other. Therefore,
right.
And I'll just finish, then I'll let you say what
please,
you
please.
That the any sense of the self, any part of ourselves that hasn't submitted to the mystical truth that there's only one and not two, will always be endeavoring to stand apart from or see itself as being separate from that absolute non-dual singularity. And
right.
so this raging force of love, this non-dual singularity, will never recognize or respond to or compromise its own nature for any movement, gross or subtle, in the consciousness of any other that insists on being seen as separate from that one without a second.
Hmm.
And that's just what that's what its nature is. That's what our true nature is. And so from a spiritual point of view, I mean that singularity is, you know, we human beings as they evolve spiritually realize that as they awaken to it, this energy, this intelligence, this drive, the nature of which is, you know, which is love beyond relative distinctions, it appears to be aspiring to, as I was saying, to really consume and absorb as much any and all consciousness that sees itself as being separate from that.
Right. Received. I mean, received in the, you know, in all of its largeness and all of its wonder. So thank you and deep bow. And I mean, my actually felt sense in the moment in first person is love, right? You know, and so let me try and, in that receiving, let me try and unfold. And it actually, what happened as I actually delighted in this kind of, you know, 19, 20 minute kind of unfolding, you know, beautiful dharmic unfolding and this kind of holding of this kind of deep truth and realization. Right, you know, the truth not of cognition, but you know, where cognition expresses realization, is it, as it does in any, in real authentic Dharma conversation, which is so rare, you know, it crystallized, you know, in me again, you know, where the difference in emphasis is. And so let me try and kind of, you know, again, take some time and just try and gradually, you know, as you did, kind of unfold it, you know, for you and kind of see what emerges with again, the kind of guiding principle being not a theological, you know, technical distinction or a kind of, well, conceptually, Andrew, I think that this might be off or that structurally. No, nothing like that at all. But more about how you tell the story, you know, about the kind of emphasis in the story. And so let me try and kind of start from there and maybe to begin with just a personal experience, right? Because, you know, the personal experience, not in that kind of subjective egoic sense, but the authority of ultimate experience, you know, in the ways that it guides us is unbelievably important here. So when I was, 16, 17, you know, and then again when I came to Israel, when I was like 18, 19, I would sit in different places each time. But in Israel, I would sit in Jerusalem in the Ben Yehuda Square in Israel in the center of Jerusalem that I'm sure you've been in that, you know, central street on King George Street there. There's a large kind of mall where there's like all sorts of hustle and bustle and people passing by. And, you know, I first began to engage Hasidic mysticism, you know, at that age. And I would sometimes leave the yeshiva, you know, the formal place of study. And since I was pretty good at study, unfortunately, I was noticed when I left. So I always got in some level of trouble. You know, if you were a backbencher, you got to leave and do what you wanted. But I would go to Jerusalem and I would sometimes sit in the, you know, at a cafe, you know, on this kind of a sidewalk cafe, and just watch the people for hours, just watching the people go by. And what would happen in me
is this is gradually, and sometimes not so gradually, right, I would be, you know, and this happened to me repeatedly. It was a repeated experience in that period of time, particularly the 18 and 19-year-old period of time. I would be just overwhelmed by a kind of just unspeakable rapture of just loving the people walking by. And I was just like every face I would see, it would become so intense, right? And it filled me, you know, with just this incredible desire, not physically, but just kind of complete embrace every person there. And each person, and as the time would go by, each person's face would be just so shining. I mean, so, you know, dazzling, so incandescent, you know, so shimmering with such, you know, kind of, you know, incredible gorgeousness and beauty that it literally would take my breath away until I just couldn't bear it anymore. And I'd have to kind of, you know, as it were, come down or contract in because I just felt my body would explode. Right? And all this was, you know, just basically sitting at a cafe. I had no commerce with anyone. I didn't, you know, say hello to anyone. I wasn't shaking anyone's hand. I wasn't hugging anyone. I was just sitting at my cafe. And that experience or that set of experiences, you know, in my early life then, you know, kind of repeated themselves again. I mean, the most recent one is I actually send our dear mutual friend, Panda 10, you know, just a quick recording of it right after it happened a couple of weeks ago. And I was in Jamaica with Mariana and Zion sitting by the pool, you know, in the middle of this, you know, very, very, Andrew, I would say suspect scene, right? You know, it was one of those hotels where, you know, I was with Mariana's family, complete blessings to them. And, you know, there's like five bars open all the time. It was kind of a horror, you know. There's more food than you can possibly imagine. You're on the Jamaica beach. People are talking incessantly about nothing all the time. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm sitting by the pool in this kind of, you know, caricature scene, you know, people kind of having their very much relative conversations, you know, to major an understatement. And as I began to find my way into the faces of the people, you know, again, right, the same kind of early experience came up, and gradually each face kind of became shimmering, and beneath the relative kind of the beauty of each person kind of began to emerge, and then the kind of shimmering of the ocean kind of began to merge with the faces, and then kind of the ground of being kind of welled into it, and the very, literally like the very stones of the buildings and the rocks and the pavement and the earth itself, it just all just kind of exploded with such a shimmering, right, ecstasy that it just kind of, and I was gone. And I just had to share it, so I wrote it, you know, quickly to Ken just to kind of, you know, just to land it someplace, you know, and you know, in the heart of a friend. And so that's kind of, in some sense, the matrix, right, of my own kind of mystical experience, realization, whatever word we want to give to it, was always very much bound up with the absolute love of the relative, right, with the absolute love of the relative. You know, and so I want to kind of begin from there and try and unpack something which, you know, emerges to me from Kabbalah, and you and I have had conversations about, you know, what's in Kabbalah, what's being read into Kabbalah, and we'll have deeper conversations about that, you know, as the years go on. But this is how I've understood the Kabbalistic text based on, you know, not casual, but kind of close, intense, kind of both ecstatic and scholarly reading. But to not root it only in Kabbalah, you know, there's a great essay by Charles Peirce, who I know that you know, 1893, called Evolutionary Love. It's kind of an awesome essay. And, you know, in Desjardins, you know, that great evolutionary theorist that kind of impacted on all of us in the different ways, you know, and in my world, Abraham Cook, you know, very much came out of Peirce's kind of idea of evolutionary love. And over the last year, as I've been talking with Ken, who you've done so many, you know, awesome and incredible dialogues with, I think since 2002 or something, like, you know, for a very, very long time. So I've been talking to Ken about love. And we kind of made this decision to do integral spiritual experience about, you know, love. And I really said to Ken, like, we gotta spend a year talking about love. Integral is all about love. And we're, by the way, parentheses bracket, super excited to have you with us at Integral Spiritual Experience 3, giving this awesome keynote on the whole evolutionary context and worldview. So just kind of bracket that and note that. So, you know, this conversation I've been having with Ken really comes out of Peirce, you know, and comes out of, for me, this earlier Kabbalistic framework and Desjardins. It's all about Desjardins. So if you read Desjardins, you know, he talks about, you know, not a love that's hard to find, but a love that's impossible to avoid, which is a love that you're talking about. And that love is the affinity, you know, you know, using Duchardin's language just kind of loosely, you know, remembering it's the affinity which links and draws together the elements of the world. Right? It's the agent of universal synthesis. And Duchardin's big line that, you know, love alone can unite living beings so as to complete and fulfill them. For it alone joins them by what is deepest in them. And he writes, our most urgent need is to imagine our ability to love developing until it embraces the totality of human beings, the totality of the earth itself. You know, that someday after mastering the winds, the waves, the tides, the gravity, we shall harness for, and I add to Desjardins, and as God, right, the energies of love. And then for a second time in the history of the world, man will have discovered fire. And so what Desjardins is talking about, and the Kabbalists are all talking about, is the sense that the cosmic process, right, at its most cellular level, you know, Peirce suggests an alternative to Darwin already in 1893, right, that the kind of the cellular process, right, in which, you know, quarks come together and form an atom, you know, and atoms come together and form a molecule, you know, and molecules come together and form a cell, you know, as Ken's described emerging out of this tradition, right, this sense of, right, the evolutionary process itself, right, is motivated by a word that we both love. I wrote a book on it called The Erotic and the Holy. You talk about it all the time, Eros. Right? It's one of the places that we just meet deeply, the sense that the evolutionary process is not impersonal in that sense that's so often talked about, but it's actually, it's the deeply personal face of Eros, right, the driving force of love. And I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by personal in a second, but it's this force of Eros which drives everything. Right? And Eros is, right, by its very nature, right, this movement towards higher unity, towards higher inclusion, towards higher recognition, towards higher embrace. Right? And that process, right, takes place and drives, right, everything from the cellular level, right, up through kind of molecules, up through cells, and it is the force towards inclusion, towards recognition, towards embrace. So that very force of love, the Kabbalist Leita Tar Panuimine, if there's no place devoid of the divine. Right, and then they explain that's what it means, right? Love your neighbor as yourself, seemingly personal, relative love. Ani Adonai, I am God, right? You know, Kabbalist, who is love, right? Meaning that love which drives the evolutionary process, right, itself, right, then moves up through kind of, you know, animals and mammals and, you know, higher animals and higher mammals and, you know, neural nets and neural cords and higher levels of, you know, awareness, till we get to the human being who's aware of him herself, and then the human being, right, goes to higher and higher levels of inclusion and embrace, right? You know, beyond kind of deficiency needs, you know, Maslow's deficiency needs, you know, belongingness, physiological needs, self-esteem, self-actualization, which are all based on being deficient, what you would call relative, right? These deficiency needs are relative, and then they jump to self-transcendence needs, right? And this kind of desire for, you know, to give, right, to embrace. But even the deficiency needs are motivated by love, right? In other words, and that actually every movement, right, towards engagement, right, every movement towards recognition of other, even when it's thwarted love, right, even when it doesn't fulfill itself in its pristine clarity, but the movement of one human being to another, right, that relative movement, right, that relative movement to recognize another human being, even if it's distorted, right, by prisms of early trauma, by obsession with woundedness, you know, by hyper-inflated, you know, contemporary narcissism. So we need to disambiguate, you know, those ambiguities. We need to, you know, cleanse, right, the doors of perception, right? We need to kind of focus in and crystallize and feel, right, and realize that actually the love that draws us together, that when I say I love you in the beginning of the conversation, Mark to Andrew, right, I'm recognizing, I'm moving towards union with, I'm embracing, and that same love is the love that drives the evolutionary process. That the evolutionary process is, right, animated at its very core by love, and it's love all the way up, all the way down, not love as a weak force, but love as the strongest force that is. Love as the shattering, right, strong, explosive force that you're describing, whose essential nature reaches towards ever deeper levels of creative explosion and caring and concern, right, and holding, right, and compassion. And so paradoxically, right, in that understanding, right, I would frame it, right, a little differently, right? Not only, right, would I intuitively not say that there's literally no relationship at all, right, between the relative and the absolute, I would say they're actually a precise continuum. they're actually the same thing at their core. They actually taste, they're actually part of the same taste of love. That actually the same love that's driving the whole process, right, is precisely driving, right, that commitment between human beings and that commitment beyond world-centric. You know, from a cosmocentric perspective, right, it's the love, right, for all sentient beings. And when that love's not awakened, then we eat hamburgers. Right? In other words, and that's what's the cosmocentric perspective,
well,
as we both...
I bet you there must be a few enlightened people out there that eat hamburgers.
Right. We'll come back to that. I appreciate taking a stand for the hamburgers, right? But if we actually feel into it, right, and what do we mean by love? We mean that I actually, you know, when I move from ego to ethnocentric, right, ego, I'm just concerned with me, you know, distinctions that we both use all the time. But ethnocentric, I'm deeply concerned with everyone in my tribe, and we see it, you know, most powerfully in sports events. People are completely identified with their local team, even though has nothing. There's this feeling. Then you move to world-centric, this identity with all human beings. Then you move to cosmocentric, all sentient beings. And as long as we're not identified with all sentient beings, then care and compassion doesn't extend there, right? But this rising and expanding and deepening of care.
Just one in terms of the last distinction. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to weigh in on that. I would say that. That a cosmocentric, I think it's not, I would, all sentient beings, but it's for the process itself. Rather than just all sentient beings. And I know there are different people interpret it in different ways, but.
Actually, on cosmocentric, without getting, because I want to finish the thought, but without
sure.
getting, I agree
sure.
on cosmocentric. Cosmocentric would be, the way I would actually define it is identity with all sentient beings, and I would use actually, Chaim of Elezion, the way he talks, doesn't use the term cosmocentric, but the way he talks about that level of consciousness is I move from my side to God's side, I'm actually identified with divinity unfolding itself, which
right.
I think closer
exactly.
to what you're saying.
That's
so
right.
yeah, I'm actually in terms of just kind of holding that completely with that. But in terms of the larger picture, so what begins to emerge is, right, is this understanding that this fifth force of the universe that, you know, Andrew Kaufman and other people like, you know, Bernard Haysh, you know, that I think you actually reviewed one of his books in your magazine and the Santa Fe Institute people that talk about this fifth force, you know, beyond the strong and the weak and beyond electromagnetic and beyond nuclear and beyond gravity, this fifth force of, you know, this movement towards self-organization to higher levels of order, you know, the inside of that, right, that's the outside view, but the inner view, the inside reality that's being described there, right, is actually the emergence of love, right? It's the emergence of love moving towards higher and higher levels of unity. And when that kind of emerges and explodes at the human level, right, it explodes as relative love, paradoxically. Now, there's more confused relative love, for sure, right? There's the experience of falling in love where you believe that the love object, right, is the whole story, right? And then when the love object disappears, right, you know, love is gone. And so that of course is a mistake because the object admits the light, but then it closes and then we wonder kind of, you know, what did I ever see in her? When I don't realize that actually the reason, I think Houston Smith has this great thing that he says back in the day, he talks about a piece of quartz. I mean, I remember hearing this from him, you know, piece of quartz, you know, on the beach, which is hit by sunlight in a particular way. And then when the, you know, you feel the quartz is completely illuminated, but actually what's happening is the quartz is illuminated because the sunlight is moving through it in a particular way. So the love object, of course, is not love, right? Love is spirit itself. But the love object, right, refracts, expresses spirit. And when I see, right, the person that I love, when I reach towards a person in love, it actually is spirit seeing spirit, true self seeing true self, and unique self seeing unique self, right? And it's that same love that actually motivates evolution. So that actually, paradoxically, what emerges is, and here's this kind of wild, funny thing, that actually loving your dog, right, and in the awakened sense, you know, let me say this in the most extreme way and then kind of bring it back down to earth, in the awakened sense of kind of realizing that your dog is an expression of and is holding a, you know, what a capitalist would call a nitzos, a spark of divinity, right? Now, perhaps a, you know, a limited spark, you know? The dog doesn't know that it has Buddha mind. Okay, so it's not conscious. So it's pre-rational. It's not trans-rational. Nonetheless, right, the core experience of love as it moves up and down, right, all the way up and all the way down, is the one spirit evolutionary love. And what that does is it confers enormous dignity on the personal. Right? Not that I'm lost in the personal, but that I actually realize that through my love of other, I actually glimpse the divine. Right? I mean, you know, when Dante sees Beatrice, right, you know, in whom he talks heaven's glory walked, you know, in the earthly body, I mean, what is he saying? But it's not so much that he projects infinity upon her, but it's rather he glimpses infinity, right? He glimpses the infinite through her, right? So the person or that which we love, right, becomes a refraction, right, of infinity, and my movement towards union with it, towards recognition of it, towards care of it, towards compassion for it, right, all is the very expression, right, of the divine movement, you know, which initiates the Big Bang, which from a non-dual perspective is emerging, right, is emerging through us as us, right? It's the very...
I understand what you're saying, but I think if I can respond, I think there's a few other issues we have to bring to the table here. So I think if I understand everything that you're saying, that you're trying to make the point that you know that it's the power of love that's driving everything at all levels, at all times, in every interaction, no matter what seems to be happening or appears to be happening from anybody's perspective and everybody's perspective, it's the force, it's the power, it's the nature of love that's driving the entire creative process.
And it is good. Praise, right? But just to calibrate it, so what that means is that actually, and again, paradoxically, we kind of dance around the same conversation. It's not that different in some sense. I realized as you were talking between the conversation about unique self and authentic self that these conversations are actually related in some deep sense, right? That actually, right, my emphasis would be that there's an absolute continuum between the absolute and the relative. That actually, from a non-dual, tense, I'll pass it right over, from a non-dual perspective, the absolute and the relative, right, are both expressions of the same one. Right, the same love moves them both, and the reason that's significant, right, is that it doesn't mean that we don't have to free ourselves from separate self. Of course we do, right? It doesn't mean that we don't want to free ourselves from the contraction of the ego and from the pettiness, right, that creates actually, right, you know, the brutality and the grasping and the destruction of the world. Of course we do, because that's the clarifying of love. But if we begin from a kind of starting point and we recognize, you know, I was just in Jamaica, Andrew, so I get to say one love, right? You know, Bob Marley, yes, right, one love. If we recognize that it's one love, that evolutionary love is one love, and we kind of hold that continuum, it actually confers infinite dignity on the personal, because actually the distinction between the personal and impersonal are actually blurred, and they merge, you know, beyond personality, right, into a higher impersonal, personal one-loveness. So that's to kind of calibrate and put it out there. And holding it not as, you know, last sentence, okay, not as, this is in no sense, and I'll make this clear to people listening, this is not in any way a rejection of anything you or in third person, anything Andrew said, not at all. But it's a different way of telling the story where, you know, one emphasis was, you know, as you said beautifully several times, you know, there's literally no relationship at all one to the other, right, you know, the absolute and the relative love. And the way I'm telling the story, although theologically I'm sure technically we both agree, I'm saying, you know, actually one love. Actually, there's total relationship between them. They're actually expressions of the same force living in us, as us, and through us. So that's a sense of a, you know, to dance with that together.
Okay, well, I think, to be honest, if we're going to...
I mean, it's an exciting conversation.
Yeah, I know. It is a very exciting conversation. But we would need about 3 to 4 hours in order to be actually to be able to respond to each other. And so, in other words, I'm not sure if a 90-minute format for the nature of...
Right.
Question is unfolding is going to be able to do justice either to what I may really think or feel about this and or the way you may really think or feel about it. But I mean, a couple of responses. Number one, my hesitation about what you've described is that would be this, that your description as love as being the prime mover of all movement, gross or subtle, all the way from matter to spirit, at all times and all places, through all circumstances, no matter how it may seem to any particular individual, no matter what appears to be happening in every circumstance, of course it's true. I mean, because that's the nature of that's the nature of what love from an absolute or non-dual perspective is. But the reason that I find it problematic is because in making these distinctions, in other words, I think the question of what love is an important one, because there is a very clear relation, because love, I feel, in the reality of human life, is a word that points to that which we hold as being most dear, and that which we hold as being most true, that which we hold as having the greatest value. So it's not just necessarily an emotional experience or a powerful feeling, but what we're calling love always points to what we hold, as I was just saying, as to what hold as being most dear and having the greatest value. So when we speak about the nature of love as it relates to the whole world of manifestation, the human experience, then there's a clear relationship between what we call love, what we mean by love, and morals.
Mm-hmm.
And because we often hear, for example, people say, well, God is love. You say, okay, well, if it's a kind of love in which if it's love in its non-dual form, where there are no distinctions being made, but we see it as being all-embracing and all-inclusive,
mm-hmm.
then it as true as it may be within an absolute context or within a non-dual context, it really doesn't help us at all, and I mean at all, in order to be able to make very real, important distinctions in the realm of real life. So completely agreed there. So because a lot of what love is all about has to do with, as we distinguish what it is, it's about making meaning out of the human experience. And so
mm-hmm.
how we collect individually and collectively through shared agreements make meaning, you know, is how culture really evolves and develops. So for people who have for all people that really feel very deeply and care very deeply about life at all levels of development, what they love is what they care most about.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases are going to be willing to die for.
Right.
So for example, someone who we could maybe agree, you know, would be a very deeply realized saint from any tradition.
Right.
Who, let's say, we agree such and such as an individual is a saint, has reached a level of spiritual development that is awe inspiring. Is an example of someone who's become an incarnation of love in human form, who because of their level of spiritual evolution and realization is embodying a higher standard of human spiritual potential that actually brings the light, makes apparent, you know, the light and the truth of spirit in an unseeing world. But at the same time, we could say, well, there is we know someone who's a member of the Nazi Party who loves Adolf Hitler,
mm-hmm.
who loves passionately his philosophy and is willing to fight and die for it because to him or her that is the highest and most meaningful representation of truth,
mm-hmm.
of God, of love, and of spirit in the world. Now those are, I'm giving two different examples here of two different human beings who claim to love God and love truth and the implications of their the position that they're taking has an actual effect on the world that we're living in here. So when we're beginning to talk about the meaning of love as it relates to the so-called relative world, then, at least in my way of thinking, if love is going to have meaning, if it's going to be purposeful, then it has to be, it would have to be a kind of love that makes distinctions between, you know, now we are emerging out of absolute non-duality, and now
right.
we have to make, and you know, and being a good Jew as you are, this is you would relish in as much as I do, which is then we have to begin to make very important distinctions between good and evil.
And now we're in the world of the relative. Now that's not absolute. Now we're in the relative. Now we're in relative distinctions.
Well, it's true, but from the perspective of spirit as being of non-dual spirit,
right?
It seems to be that it's non-dual spirit that's aspiring to make these kinds of distinctions, because for example,
which is exactly where relative and absolute merge as one.
Right. Well, when our forefathers, you know, when our forefathers were in the desert and they came up with the Ten Commandments, they were saying, hey guys and gals, you know, we have to take a step up here to a higher level of spiritual development and stop being so brutal to each
right.
other. We have to stop raping and killing and pillaging and,
right.
have to behave like be in a more civilized way. And this, as we understand, how cultural evolution works and spiritual evolution works, we realize that God, in the form of love, in the form of spiritual realization, was compelling a particular tribe or particular group of people to evolve to a higher level of development. So non-dual spirit is also in the world of mm-hmm. in the world of form, compelling or giving rise to this vertical ascent, this vertical
mm-hmm.
aspiration. And so then the distinctions that enter into the conversation at that point become all important and very, very delicate, because then there's the distinction between higher and lower, between good
yep.
and evil, between good and bad, between more spiritual and less spiritual, between the sacred and the profane, and all the rest of it. And so that's when this kind of conversation gets very interesting, because now we want to, without denying the absolute or non-dual nature of spirit, we also want to boldly enter into the world of form and the world of time and the world of distinctions and see, well, what does the love of God, the love of non-dual spirit, what does that actually mean about the creative process as it relates to real human beings who are very much in part and parcel of an intersubjective cultural process,
mm-hmm.
especially for those individuals who are trying to make new forms of meaning, you know, at the leading edge of the beginning of the 21st century, because we're all trying to find our way, and those who are most inspired to do it tend to be individuals who are inspired by the non-dual nature of spirit. But what happens then is the inherently flattening out effect that can happen when we say that love is everything makes it difficult for us to make this. To make these distinctions that arise from this kind of vertical ascent as eros, as you were using, you know, quite a bit that word, eros is the drive towards that which is higher.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a vertical ascent there, and then there's a drive towards making ever greater and greater distinctions. So like our forefathers back in the desert, you know, were being driven. they were being driven to stop behaving like beasts and depraved, you know, these depraved roving hordes of rape of pillagers and rapists,
right.
and to come up with some shared agreements here which would make it possible to behave in a more civilized way with each other, which would give rise to and being able to do that, you know, learning how to treat each other with greater respect and greater care and less violence and brutality, would create the cultural, the life conditions that would give rise to the capacity to have even more subtle intuitions about maybe where spirit was leading us. So I agree with you wholeheartedly, without conditions, that the nature of what we're agreeing on is love is driving the whole process. But I think it gets really interesting, challenging, and very, very interesting when we say, well, love is driving the process, and love as Eros, which is this vertical ascent, is compelling us to make very difficult but all-important moral distinctions. You know, and of course, Jews are very good.
Those forefathers there.
Jews, this is one thing that Jews are very good at, and this is Judaism, of course, as you know better than I do, is very much based on making these kinds of distinctions. But so as we agree that the nature of what's driving the whole process is non-relative, is absolute, is non-dual, at the same time, as it works within the world of form that it gave rise to, then its own nature begins to take on these different shapes and forms, one being higher, one being lower. And so from a non-dual perspective, we say, well, there isn't any difference because that which is high and that which is low is all of the same mystical substance. But at the same time, we can say, well, that is true, but then that mystical substance is also giving rise to that which is higher and that which is lower. And as we notice that as we give more of our attention to that which is higher and begin to remove our attention from that which is lower, then something miraculous called interior, vertical, evolutionary, spiritual development begins to occur at the level
right.
of self and at the level of culture. And then we could say that God or spirit begins to become more, we notice that drive is spirit. And so there are these two different dances going on.
Right.
And I think that the most sophisticated way to approach this, at least in my understanding, is learning how to hold both these perspectives simultaneously and honoring both at the same time and learning how to keep a real balance there.
Right. So yes. So I'm just, wait, the first thing that kind of comes to mind is, let me just say maybe the first thing before the first thing, which is yes, this actually requires, I'm actually realizing, I'm having the same realization, that requires several hours to unfold. So let's view this as a first installment and a work in progress, and we can kind of go back and recalibrate and deepen, and things will come up afterwards. Like when we talked the other day, I think I wrote you an email that 10 things, that the mark of a good conversation is 10 things that were really vital, you know, came up like in the next 2 hours afterwards. So I'm sure that will happen here, but within the framework of, you know, where we are right now. So there's a paradox at play. So on the one hand, and I'm just going to kind of, you know, think this through as I kind of talk it out loud, because it's a kind of new territory, and that's why it's exciting kind of to push the edges of it. So on the one hand, you know, an absolute love, right, and this kind of absolute distinction between an absolute love and a relative love, right, by itself doesn't allow for the important distinctions of ethics in the world of the relative. So that's the first thing. So now, paradoxically, both the position that you presented and the position that I presented, which we both agree aren't cognitively exclusive but actually are different emphasis, both can be distorted, meaning that both could actually suffer a weakness if they're taken to their inappropriate extreme, meaning both the split between the absolute and the relative doesn't allow for the appropriate distinctions, right, in the world of the relative, the moral distinctions that actually allow us to actually emerge, right, and actually, you know, have this kind of vertical arising of development. So that's level one. And, right, a kind of homogenization, right, of everything is love, right, also on the other side, you know, won't allow, you know, for those distinctions, which we, you know, the moral context that we both think is so essential. So paradoxically, we need to go to kind of an apex, right? In other words, that actually each position suffers from a weakness. You know, the one love position suffers from a weakness that it doesn't hold the distinction of the relative. But then, of course, the absolute distinction between absolute love and relative love suffers from the same weakness. So we need to kind of find the place in which, right, absolute love, right, expresses itself, manifests itself, right, as the Eros driving the evolutionary process, right, and that evolutionary process, as that Eros drives the evolutionary process,
to ever higher levels of increase, right, of recognition, of union. So part of that, right, is this increased sophistication and deepening of discernments. Right? And the nature paradoxically of those discernments, and here's the key sentence that I want to say, is that all of those distinctions lead back towards, right, the absolute oneness, right? Meaning what I'm doing as my structure stages are emerging in vertical development, and I'm distinguishing and distinguishing and distinguishing, what I'm actually saying is that I'm actually giving more and more value. I'm extending my circles of care and compassion beyond, you know, their natural egoic limits, and I'm including more and more people, and I'm giving infinite value and dignity, right, to more and more people until I actually realize that all people and actually all sentient beings and actually all of reality, right, is actually awake and is divinity itself, and that, so I move beyond the initial kind of contraction right after the involution, you know, and as I kind of begin the journey back to God and to a higher level of God, all the distinctions that I make, as I make them, those distinctions paradoxically move me back to the one. And that is the love, right, that drives the distinction. Actually, in Hebrew, the word, you know, ahava, right, love is 13, and the word echad, one, is 13. So the Kabbalist kind of an internal kind of Kabbalistic kind of way of saying kind of, you know, a kind of koan of realization, 13 and 13 is 26, which is the name of God. So that love is one, you know, love is 13, one is 13, 13 and 30, 13 is 26, meaning it's the name of God, which is all of reality, which is the love that perceives, right, the underlying unity, right, or the underlying infinite value, right, in all that is, and therefore loves it for what it is, not in a way which effaces hierarchy, not in a way which undermines deeper and deeper emergences of value, but in a way in which, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, I am God, right, that love that powers the whole system, right, refines itself, right, because love reveals itself primarily, right, in its active face, right, not merely as a third-person force, which is its ground, but it becomes active as a verb, right, as, you know, as a perception. Love becomes an ability to discern, to see, you know, to perceive, right, you know, Ibn Arabi, you know, that's everything that he talks about. Love as a perception is to see the infinite dignity, value, gorgeousness of other and all the realms of other, right, and to identify other with that infinite dignity and gorgeousness, and then to affirm, right, and to therefore live for, to stand for the other's highest growth, right? So love is this mixture of standing for, right, seeing the infinite potential in other, right, identifying them with that infinite potential, and then standing for, right, their highest growth, their highest evolution, even when, as you said in the very beginning, that might not seem so loving on the outside, right? In other words, that kind of loving, and I think that's what you were talking about in the beginning, that kind of loving where you actually, you know, Hebrew love, the actual word means radical giving, right? So the radical giving, the radical commitment based on love's perception of the infinite value and dignity, that's the discernment, the distinction that you're talking about, actually moves love to this terrifying demand, right, that the other grow into the highest that they can possibly be, right? So the whole story, and I think that's what you were pointing to, but that's certainly what I'm feeling, is that the whole story is held in this, you know, wondrous paradox.
Well, right? And the greatest prophets and seers and realizers throughout history from all the great traditions have been such individuals, as you described, who were so smitten by the nature of non-relative or absolute love that they became human expressions and embodiments of its nature, and in light of their reflection, other human beings were able to, you know, to glimpse what was possible, in spiritual evolution. I mean, we can only see what's possible, really, I think, in others. And I also think that I think that the nature of what God is, and if this conversation is, you know, the nature of love, if God is love, then I think it's really only possible to see the full flowering of what love is in great prophets and great saints and great seers and great realizers.
Where it's not all sweetness and light.
Well, no, well, that's true. But, I mean, to me, there's more or less two expressions of love in terms of the way I understand and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
One, you know, one is what you and I have just been talking about, what I was just saying, was the expression of spiritual realization in, you know, in the greatest seers and realizers and saints and prophets, in holy men and women and individuals who really, they're really not like everyone else. They're really on the other side. They've discovered a different source of self, and their very being, you know, emanates and expresses that spontaneously, unselfconsciously, radically, powerfully, and forthrightly in such ways that really do that touch other people and really reveal to them and point them towards what's possible and also call them towards what's possible. But the other expression of love, which is more commonly recognized and understood, but is also very, very powerful, of course, is compassion. And, of course, when we recognize compassion, especially when it touches us the most, is when we are in trouble, when we are suffering, when we're in pain, when it's could be emotional and psychological pain. We could be in physical pain. We may have been in an accident. We may be terribly injured. We may be isolated and alone, desperately in need. And so when we see other human beings selflessly reaching out to help us and to heal us, to feed us, to give us shelter, to tend to our wounds and woundedness and to support us, especially when we see that this care is coming from a selfless place, it is awe-inspiring. It touches us deeply when we realize that other people simply care about our well-being because they care about our well-being, because they simply care. And especially when we are suffering, when we've been hurt, and when we're wounded, and if it could be an emotional wound, but even more significantly, I would say, if it's a physical wound, and when we feel vulnerable, we can no longer take care of ourselves, and we feel the unselfish care of particular individuals who express a kind of compassion, where there's a selfless, really sense of care for our well-being, for our comfort, for our relief from suffering. It is awe-inspiring. I mean, it's awe-inspiring, and for any of us who's ever been in had moments, or hopefully not so long, but if we've had moments in our lives when we have experienced that kind of vulnerability, and other people have reached out to us unselfishly, then it's only then I think that we really know what compassion is, because it's a kind of care that really is not personal, and it's not that it really is selfless. So when we really see, oh, there is a selfless care about my well-being, that I should not suffer, that's coming from another person, and it could be a person that we have no personal relationship at all, it really it touches us very deeply. And this is another way in which we can see the light of spirit entering into the world through the expression of compassion. But that being said, I think love as the expression of selfless compassion is more commonly understood by more people to be the expression of spirit in the world, rather than the kind of love that we were speaking about earlier, the ferocious care for the evolution of human consciousness and culture. The ferocious expression of the care of what I call the evolutionary impulse. That's less commonly understood or known about. In other words, spiritual love more commonly is understood to be compassion rather than as the expression of what, you know, we use the word eros, of this vertical impulse to evolve to a higher level of individual self and cultural evolution and potential. But those, as far as I understand it, are the two of the most authentic expressions of spirit in action as I understand them. Now, we could, of course, you know, referring back to what you were saying, we could say, well, that's true, That's true. But then to include everything you were saying, yes. And then it's also true that since love is what's driving everything, that, you know, that, that my love for my dog, and that my, you know, is also an expression of spirit as love. But, and it is. But it's not at the same level. It's a different quality. It's a different quality, and it's in a different, it has a different order of significance.
That's right. No, that's
the distinction that's important here, I think.
Absolutely. And just what you said earlier, let me just kind of touch into that for a second. It seems so important. So really, what we're describing is two kinds of saints, right? You know, one saint that is kind of your kind of classical saint, that's about healing the suffering of the world, right? You know, who is this incarnation, you know, and clearly the image of, you know, the vicarious suffering of Christ, you know, kind of holds, you know, who incarnates and engages the pain of infinite contraction, right, is that image. And, of course, the suffering of Christ comes from this deep teaching of Isaiah that the Shekhinah, right, the feminine, you know, goddess divine, contracts herself, goes into exile, right, to feel the pain and, you know, and the Christian unfolding of it to atone for the pain of the world. So divinity itself is willing to contract itself, as it were, in the kind of teaching of incarnation, to give up some of itself, and whenever that mystery of Christ is in the Christian teaching, honoring, you know, that teaching and honoring that lineage, right, in order to heal the pain and the suffering of the world, which is the kind of, if you will, the divine archetype, you know, of that one vision of the saint that we're describing. That's the selfless compassion. Then there's the second image, the second saint, if you will, which is more rare, right, which is actually, you know, the evolutionary divine force, which actually paradoxically, you know, is equally caring, you know, is equally compassionate, but caring not for people from the perspective, and I don't want to say merely, because there is no merely, right, but not from the perspective of what we might say is merely, you know, but in very big quotation marks, their brokenness or their suffering, but what loves people so much that it literally can't stand to see them remaining small. It's ripped apart. The pain of the Shekhinah in this second saint, right, is the divine that actually utterly affirms, you know, infinite human dignity and infinite human adequacy and the potential, right, of every human being, and therefore, right, radically, it's both perception and giving, right, sees that, right, to love a person is to see what they already are, right, before they can see it, and then radically commits, right, to its own suspension, right, the divine, as it were, right, makes room for the human being, participates, non-dually emerges as human being in order to allow the human being, right, to fully incarnate divinely, right? And so there's these two images of love. You know, one is kind of this embrace of brokenness, a kind of agape love, if you will. And then there's a kind of, you know, this emergent love, which kind of demands emergence. You know, and so while one, and I think that's maybe where we could find the different qualities in both of them, while one is kind of the more classic, we're in Christmas season, right? The more cherubic, you know, soft, you know, tender. Tender might be the right word, right? It's tender. You know, actually the quality of the selfless compassion is kind of an infinite tenderness. It's, you know, Mother Teresa comes to mind, you know, while the quality of the evolutionary love is prophetic. Right, you know, it's kind of the raging prophet.
That's correct.
You know,
yes. These
two different, so it's tenderness and this kind of divine rage, you know, but rage in this best sense. And I really think that really feels like we've come, you know, towards the end of our time, like 5 minutes left. I think we're about 2:25, really full circle. So that actually, the two different kinds, we usually understand giving to people. Right, you know, the gift that we give to people, love as hav, H-A-V, you know, love as radical giving. We usually understand radical giving as, you know, keeping people safe. You know, we understand radical giving in terms of, you know, maybe we might say Maslow's, you know, belongingness, you know, self-actualization, self-esteem needs, giving people those needs. So that's one level of giving, and that's one level of loving, and it's beautiful, and it's holy, and as you said, I think the word you used was so beautiful, it's awe-inspiring. And like, we can only like reverentially bow and kneel and kiss the ground in front of that. What else could we possibly do? And as you said so beautifully, if you've ever been vulnerable in some real way, you know at a point in my life when I was particularly, you know, vulnerable and hurt in some deep and real way,
you know, the people that, you know, kind of spoke to me and held me then are precious to me in this infinite way, and they were holding this divine face. But there's this other face of love, which is terrifying, right? Which is, but it's love no less. It is that evolutionary force pulsing through all that is, demanding, you know, emergence and being willing to settle for no less and pushing and pushing through.
And submission. Submission.
And submission. Yeah, absolutely. It's submission.
The voice that says, submit to me and me alone.
Right.
It's God. It's thy will be done, not my will, but thy will be done. It's an all or nothing request. I want all of you. I don't want just a part of you. I want all of you for myself.
Right. Radical monogamy.
God's very selfish because he or she wants everything from us. But of course, then once we're willing to submit at that level, then of course, as I said before, we completely new life. An old life ends and a completely new life begins. And unless we're willing to submit that much, the new life won't begin. We will still be in the old life while we're still having some kind of spiritual intuitions maybe, or maybe some spiritual insights, but we're going to be still living the old life. And it's only when we're willing to submit wholeheartedly, unconditionally, energetically, and completely once and for all and forever that a truly new life begins, and that new life, and then what happens is that we become then an expression of spirit in action. We're no longer living to have and to get and become for ourselves, but we become an incarnation of spirit in the world in human form. And that's what's so exciting, and that's what more and more of us, I think, need to do so we can really take responsibility for evolution at the level of culture, for a cultural evolution and cultural revolution that's so desperately needed now. And thank you so much, Mark, for this conversation. And we're just getting started. I think we do need about 3 hours to really discuss a lot of the different distinctions we were making so we can really come to a greater agreement. I think this is more of an introduction to a lot of complex and interesting ideas and distinctions.
First of all, thank you, Andrew. It was a delightful introduction, and
I very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I look forward to next time. We'll set it up.
Absolutely.
And good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos, sir.
Good Shabbos, sir. Love you, Andrew.
Lots of love. Thank you so much.